Good evening, everyone. My name is Leah Paul-Gashville, and I'm the president of the GMU Economics Society. On behalf of the Econ Society, we'd like to thank everyone for coming out tonight. We'd also like to thank the Mercatus Center for co-sponsoring this event with us. We definitely would not have been able to do it without them. The Mercatus Center is a university-based research center, and one of the things that they offer to the MA students is a fellowship. The fellowship is a competitive program for students who are interested in pursuing an advanced degree in applied economics in preparation for a career in public policy. And the fellowship includes full tuition and a generous stipend. And it's also aimed at students interested in advanced training in economics. The Mercatus Master's Fellows have the opportunity to author or co-author policy studies, academic papers, and op-eds. Interested students should apply for admission to the GMU MA program and Mercatus MA Fellowship at the same time. The deadline is March 15th. It's coming up, and I definitely encourage all of the interested students to apply for the program. And you can find the application on Mercatus.org or come talk to us afterwards, and we'll find someone who will be able to talk to you about the program.
My name is Carly Reddig, and I'm also an officer in the GMU Economics Society. If you're interested in learning more about the Econ Society, we are an organization dedicated to educating students about economics. Just come up to us after the event and learn more about it, or to sign up. We're extremely fortunate to have our panelists discuss the political and economic change in Egypt tonight with us. Our panelists tonight are Dr. Ramachandran, Chris Coyne, Jack Goldstone, and Peshwas Fazula. Dr. Ramachandran recently retired after some 25 fascinating years working on a wide range of issues and countries at the World Bank and the IMF. Some of these included banking reforms in Latin America, privatization in Eastern Europe, and the transformation of their economies, and the financial crisis of East Asia. He has also contributed to and authored major reports, including Economic Growth in the 1990s, Learning from a Decade of Reform, and the development of a policy review report on Egypt, and most recently, Natural Hazards, Unnatural Disasters, the Economics of Effective Prevention.
Chris Coyne is the F.A. Harper Professor of Economics at the Mercatus Center and a member of the Department of Economics at George Mason University. He is also the North American editor of the Review of Austrian Economics and a member of the Board of Scholars for the Virginia Institute of Public Policy. He was also named the Hayek Fellow at the London School of Economics in 2008. He received his PhD in economics from George Mason University and has since authored and edited numerous academic articles, book chapters, and policy studies. Professor Coyne is the author of After War, The Political Economy of Exporting Democracy.
Jack A. Goldstone is the Virginia E. and John T. Hazel Professor of Public Policy and a senior fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He received his PhD in sociology from Harvard University, and he has authored or edited 10 books and published over 100 articles in books and scholarly journals. He is currently director of the Center for Global Policy in Mason School of Public Policy and editor of Foreign Policy Bulletin.
And finally, Pashwa Fazula is currently an editor for the Atlas Economic Research Foundation, working with their Kurdish, Persian, and Arabic websites. Prior to beginning his work, he was managing editor of the Halada, the highest circulated newspaper in northern Iraq, and on the editorial board of the independent news agency's Voices of Iraq. He received his BA in English from Soleimani University and his MS in journalism from the Columbia University in New York. And we'll start off with each of the panelists, and then we'll open in the discussion for Q&A. So without further ado, let's give a warm welcome to our panelists.
Good evening. I thought I'd stand with these two things in my hand, and I hope I have enough coordination to click through a few slides that give you a picture. What I wanted to do this evening was simply to take you through a little bit of the structure of Egypt's economy. My focus is primarily on economics, not on the political science, although obviously for development the politics is important. So I want to give you a little bit of the background to Egypt's economy. I want to give you a flavor of some of the hidden inefficiencies in the economy and the neglected policies. Some of the policies were being changed, but they were quite slow to change, and you will appreciate why it's so difficult. And this would then suggest why, even now, after the political changes, the same economic challenges will remain. And although the changes hold some promise, the popular politics populism per se might be quite harmful. Egypt has prospered over the last several decades, and you can't see a lot of the details, and I have many other charts, but this gives you a very rough picture that over the last 50 years or so, incomes have grown in Egypt. And if you look at the structure of the economy, you see this in most economies that develop. Agriculture grows very slowly, manufacturing grows more rapidly, and services grow even more fast. But included in these services for Egypt is the Suez Canal. And the Suez Canal is a big, major source of foreign revenues an important organization in the country. Now, the other change that has taken place over the last 50 years is that Egypt is now much more closely linked to the OECD countries. And I won't go into the background of why we did this kind of analysis, but basically this is a correlation of how Egypt's growth is related to the growth of other countries. And you can see a marked shift after about 1985. So after 1985, whether it's for policy reasons or other reasons, the economy of Egypt is more closely linked with the rest of the world, particularly the developed countries. Now, the policies have also changed. Now, you've got to understand some of these because the ouster of the British from the Suez Canal has left a very, very sharp and deep impression still in Egypt. And socialism followed independence, as it did in many other developing countries. Land was redistributed, nationalization that took place, but the government led most of the industrialization. There were trade restrictions, as had happened in many of the countries in around the world. But all of these policies began to change in the 1980s, not just in Egypt, but all over the world, when people began to realize that perhaps allowing markets to function was a better way for countries to develop. But there was a peculiar problem in Egypt, which you'll begin to appreciate later, which is that the rhetoric and actions were not always in step, and that the external forces, like balance of payments crises, and was really what drove many of the changes. It was not a deep political consensus. So this was why many of the policies began to shift. And of course, the effect of US aid made the rhetoric of Egypt more market-oriented. And that change took place more rapidly than the actual changes that occurred. Now, the graph here begins to show the share in employment, GDP, and investment of the private and the public sector. And there's actually an interesting graph because when you look at it over the last 30 years or so, the share of employment and of GDP has not changed perceptibly, but the share of investment has changed dramatically. Private investment share has risen. And again, this suggests how one can lie or mislead with statistics. There's actually more to it than just a shift to the private sector, because if you disaggregate it in some fashion, you will see that what has actually happened is that the investment, public investment, has declined, whereas private investment has not declined as rapidly. So the shares have changed in the favor of the private sector. But what this really is a symptom of is that the public sector has become somewhat impoverished. And that's a source of a lot of the problems in Egypt. When we did the report on Egypt, a very detailed analysis of the flow of funds. Nobody had done that before. It took a lot of effort. But what we found was that the households saved roughly 16% of GDP. GDP, for those, we use it almost like everybody understands what it is. It's a measure of the output of the economy. So rather than think in terms of absolute dollar amounts, it's often convenient to think of shares of that of total output. So households save a healthy part of their incomes. They save it in banks, but banks lend to the government, both directly and indirectly. And so what essentially happens is that the private sector is not being loaned funds through the banking system, which really is a vehicle to finance the budget deficit of the government. Now, all of this is sort of a bit oriented towards the government. But when you look at the structure of the people, this is the age structure of Egypt, and it's actually quite telling. And you see this all through the Middle East, by the way. It's a classic pyramid shape, which suggests that almost half the people in Egypt are below the age of about 35 or 40. So both Egypt and the entire region is a region of very young people. And the demographic transition that has taken place more briefly in countries like China and elsewhere has been extended in this region. But birth rates are falling, and infant mortality has fallen tremendously, and so on. So there are good changes. But what this suggests is that employment and education are both terribly important in this country. And you'll see that these are the two things that the government could be doing a lot more of and has neglected somewhat sadly. Now, I put up a few numbers here, and this is actually quite telling. And this gives you a thumbnail sketch of employment in Egypt. So of a total of about 74 million people, about 45 million are in the working age group, the working age population. About half of them actually are in the labor force. Now, in a country like America, it's about two-thirds, at least. And that has changed slightly, but it's remarkably low. You also find that those who are counted as employed are often employed in very low productive jobs. Formal employment, and the definition of formal employment is if you pay into the social security system, in other words, you have a salary job of some sort, is only 8.5 million, of which almost 6.5 million are with the state. So the state and the government agency of various types dominates employment. Now, again, this gives you a measure of the influence that the government has in the economy. And most people aspire to a government job. Most young people, especially those with college educations, aspire to a government job because the real wages are actually higher. Not explicitly, but through a variety of benefits. Now, actually adding up these benefits is not an easy task because it's hidden in all sorts of different places. But people have, colleagues of mine, had done this effort, and even the government was surprised to see how rapidly, how much higher public wages were compared to the private sector. Now, when one looks at education, another neglected aspect of Egypt, this shows, unfortunately, the scale has gotten a bit distorted here, but it's 500, 450, and so on the y-axis. Now, Egypt actually does rather poorly in education outcomes, which was measured by something called the TIMSS, T-I-M-M-S. And what this actually shows is how terribly inefficient the education system is there, because it's not for want of spending money. Egypt spends an enormous amount on trying to educate its children. The government alone spends about 6% of GDP. And then parents spend another 3.7%. Now, you look at the payroll of the government, there are 800,000 teachers for 16 million children. You take the ratio, it's 20 to 1. Now, Fairfax County, which is relatively a well-run school system, actually has a 24 to 1 student-to-teacher ratio. So there are large numbers of teachers in Egypt. So it's not for want of teachers. But the teachers don't seem to actually teach. And in addition, there are about half as many administrators. So when you add this all up, you see how much is spent, but spent very poorly. And the education outcomes are very poor. Now, the other thing about Egypt, and the other question, so why are the parents spending over and above this? And you find it's an actually peculiar system where the rigid way in which the education is done, remember what is driving it. People are aspiring to a government job. To get a government job, you need a credential. To get the credential, you have to go to that magical four-year university where there is one exam. It's in the Arabic word for it is Thamiyama or something like that. I may mispronounce it. But it's a terribly important exam that all these students have to take. So the parents, knowing that the students are not being taught at schools, start hiring the very same teachers at night to tutor the students. So you can see the nature, the structural nature of the problem here. Now, these demands on the government have also given rise to other aspects that ministers and governments have to contend with. What I have here is a plot trying to capture not just the inflation rate, which are those little dots that go that are fairly low, but also the variability of inflation, which is shown in this range. So Egypt has suffered from bouts of high inflation. It's not that the average inflation is very high, but it's episodic. And again, that reflects the inability to really manage its economy, except when faced with crises, something gets done. And this, again, reflects its political system. Now, you all know that inflation, you know, is because of too much money. Why is there too much money? Because the government prints it when it doesn't have the tax revenue. And that happens because of its fundamental problem of being unable to raise as much in tax revenue as the government is spending. So this chart for the last, about 25, 30 years, shows that wages as a share of GDP is fairly steady. This is the aggregate, not the wage rate, but the total amount of wages that the government spends on all its employees. It's about 8 or 9% of GDP. In spite of all that excess staffing, it's not huge. Other spending is there, fairly level. Then we add on something called subsidies. Now, estimating this has been difficult, but we've succeeded in getting a fairly good estimate of this. And then above that is the capital spending on infrastructure, which, as we saw, was declining, but which is to some extent not really a recurring thing, but you know, when you have to build a new road and so on, that gets counted there as well as interest on this debt. But what you see is that in around here, where investment was low, in fact, subsidies were quite high. So in fact, it is the rise in subsidies that may have squeezed out a lot of this government spending. Now, the subsidies are not so much for food. Egypt had food riots and, in fact, gave the IMF a black eye. The IMF is a reviled institution even now in Egypt because it tried to reduce food subsidies and people rioted in the streets. But the government managed to reduce the extent of these subsidies substantially and gradually over time. What they have not been able to do is to reduce the amount of energy subsidies. And energy subsidies are not just electricity and gas, but petrol, diesel, kerosene, and so on. Now, Egypt was a net importer of oil, actually. I mean, now it became a slight net exporter because of its offshore finds, but for a long period of time, it was fairly expensive for the government to finance this cheap energy. But the effect is not only on the government budget, but it's also right through the economy. What has happened in Egypt is that certain sectors that are energy intensive benefit tremendously. And even though for the last 10 or 15 years, the government has reduced trade tariffs and reduced it to a fairly uniform level, for which it actually did get a lot of credit and accolades from the bank, the IMF, and various other economists within the country as well, people did not realize as much as they should have the effect of these energy subsidies, which act effectively to protect certain industries. Now, this has some importance in some of the developments in the political field as well, because these subsidies do not accrue just to industries, but also to industrialists. And so you have the industrialists who are close to the government making sure that their particular firms and so on are protected. So when you read in the newspapers about, well, Mubarak's family stole this money or this minister stole the money, even if they did, that's not substantial. What is far more substantial are the benefits that accrue from this kind of system. And it's not per se considered stealing, right? I mean, the government has reduced the price of energy. So if you produce cement or some other energy intensive industry, you benefit enormously. And this is the nature of the industrial political connection that one finds, not just in Egypt, but elsewhere as well. Now, this gives rise to the question, so what's the poor minister to do? Now, look at the nature of the problems that he faces. The government staffing is large, the structure is very rigid, the decisions are made centrally. And when I say centrally, I don't just mean by the central government, even though that's a big problem. Provinces have no autonomy. They have no source of revenue. There is no land tax. Cities are dependent entirely on the central government for budgetary allocation. The centralization of power extends even deeper. It is not just the Minister of Finance who can decide many of these things, or even Parliament. Many of these big decisions were always taken by, as they would jocularly say, you know who. Even though he has no expertise or understanding or appreciation whatsoever of the economic trade-offs that are involved. And this really ties the hands of many people. So as a result, the rhetoric was much easier than actions, and that is why you saw the external forces forcing the hand of many of these people. Now, will the current political change actually broaden political support and voice? I don't know. But it's very hard to see that happen quickly, and it certainly will not result just because one person is replaced by another, however good he may be. You need a different structure of decision-making, you need a different type of oversight of government actions, and you need far greater public involvement. Now, what we had here, and this was very touchy when we tried to do this, how could you possibly say this in a document that you're giving to the government? Well, we got various surveys, collated them with voice and accountability measures, and even with these measures, for whatever the shortcomings they had, you see how poorly Egypt and other countries in the Middle East compare with Brazil and India, and where China is. So this may change with the current political changes that have taken place or are taking place. But what I fear is that whatever new person or system of government that comes in place will still face the same kind of economic challenges that previous ministers have faced. The current expectation of what the government's role in the economy will be, how to get greater autonomy, how to change the actual patterns of business and commerce in the country. And that will take some time, but it can be done. We've seen how in Eastern Europe these changes have taken place over the last over 10 years, and that was rapid. And I hope this takes place. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to be more of an optimist, which is probably good. I'm probably the only one on the panel. There are a lot of questions in people's minds about what happened in North Africa in the last month. Questions such as, why Egypt, why Tunisia? These were countries that had recent good economic performance. They're certainly not the nastiest regimes in the world for all their flaws. Will this spread to other regimes? How come Iran has not fallen in line and followed this example? I mean, if people can rise up against Gaddafi, why not against the regime in Iran? And what will happen next in Egypt? So I'll try and answer all of these questions for you. It's actually not that hard to do. The reasons we've seen revolutions, and I think these are really revolutions, in Tunisia, Egypt, and now Libya, is that these are distinctive kinds of regimes, even in this region. They're regimes that were focused on one particular person rather than a government run by a ruling party, run by a military junta, or run by a traditional monarchy, the other types of dictatorships that we see in the area. Now, political scientists, oddly enough, call these sultanistic or neo-patrimonial regimes. What that really means is one person has taken such control that the boundary between the personal and the public purse kind of disappears. It's not just that leaders are stealing from the government or the people. They don't have to actually steal, commit anything illegal. They're just able to direct the budget in such a way that government spending benefits themselves, their family members, their associates, the industries in which they invest. Now, over time, sultanistic rulers tend to get more convinced of their own indispensability, and they don't see it as a big deal if they dip a little bit into the public purse. But to everybody else, the level of corruption does get pretty frightening. It is said that Mubarak's personal or family fortune is somewhere between $20 and $40 billion. Now, doesn't seem that's not Bill Gates' territory. It's getting close to it. But the Egyptian economy only generates $500 billion a year of output. So that would be the equivalent of an American leader having amassed a personal fortune of somewhat over $500 billion. So it's serious money locally. And the three dozen or so ministers and party members who were closest to Mubarak are alleged to have gained personal fortunes of an average of about $1 billion each. This in a country where 40% of the population still lives on $2 a day. A lot of these guys are now in jail. Several of the leading corrupt ministers have been arrested after Mubarak departed. So there will be a change. Same thing was true of the Ben Ali family in Tunisia. One of the WikiLeaks cables that was released from 2008 warned that the Ben Ali family was getting more and more abusive and that the corruption was so great it was starting to cramp investment and employment. Now, in a country where the leaders are corrupt, that can go on for a very long time if they have the support of the military and bureaucratic elites. But in both Tunisia and Egypt, although these regimes had started as military regimes, Mubarak himself was an Air Force officer and a hero of the 73 war, after decades in office, the regime's power became more and more focused on directing benefits to the leading family and their friends. And so what we have in Tunisia and Egypt, and Libya for that matter as well, and a lot of the countries in the Middle East, you have a situation in which economies are growing, but the benefits are being concentrated at the top rather than benefiting people broadly. Now, in the history of revolutions, what we find is that often countries whose macroeconomic performance is good are the ones that have revolutions. So Iran in 1979 was actually a thriving economy. Even going back to the French Revolution, France was doing fine. But the benefits were concentrated at the top, and it was the persistence of widespread, obvious poverty at a time when it was obvious to everyone that the economy was growing that struck people as so painfully unjust and unfair and turned people against the government. Now, as Ram said, there are several factors that really came to a head in the last few years. First of all, global food prices have been spiking up. In fact, the sample food basket of cereals and basic cooking oils that the Food and Agriculture Organization tracks for the UN, the basket of basic goods had a price increase of almost 33% in the last 6 months of 2010. And by December, those prices were an all-time record. Now, in Egypt, minimum wage has not been raised for 26 years. So when you get a spike in food prices, it really cuts into the budget of people who are poor. Still, we know that revolutions are not led by poor people. They are mobilizable, but usually too worried about making ends meet. The leadership of revolutions usually comes from a more frustrated but privileged class who feels that they are being cut out of the benefits of growth as well. And in North Africa, the college-educated youth have become a very large and angry group. Libya, Tunisia, and Egypt all invested, at the urging of World Bank, in higher education. In Tunisia, the number of college-educated youth tripled in the last 10 years. In Egypt, it doubled in the last 20 years. Even in Libya, there was a tenfold growth from a very small base of college-educated youth in the last quarter century. So all these countries have been pushing people in the doors of colleges. But the quality of college education has been terrible. Many of the degrees are worthless because they're in religious studies or ancient literature. Vocational training has been very largely neglected. And teachers are frequently absent. Half the students drop out before they complete college. And so they have the experience of being in college, but they are very frustrated that what they have been given by state education, and over 80% of the students go to public universities, what they've been given by state education is kind of a worthless promise. Now, it used to be the case that the government would guarantee jobs for college graduates. That was one way that people got this sense that you want to get a college degree because if you succeed, government will guarantee you a job with good benefits. But as part of the efforts to follow structural adjustment and increasingly privatize the economy, the governments in North Africa were told, stop doing these guaranteed jobs, stop subsidizing food, let the market work. Well, the way the market worked is that the older generation that had guaranteed government jobs kept them, and the younger generation found itself unable to get those jobs, unwilling to take others, and so unemployment is surprisingly concentrated among those with college educations. In fact, the unemployment rate in Egypt for those who have been to college is 10 times higher than for those who only had an elementary school education. It's a very strange situation, but about 90% of the unemployed are young people under 30, and about half of those are young people who have had some college education. So they've been angry, and they've been organizing for the last couple of years, youth movements, working with labor, strikes, and so on. We didn't hear about all that because it was kind of percolating around in the background, but people have been hurt by high prices, unemployment, and low wages, and increasingly so. Now, in a lot of countries, poor countries, the informal sector acts as kind of a safety valve. People go into selling small, carts. They work at casual labor. And in countries with a fairly weak state, people are more or less free to pick up whatever work they can. But countries in North Africa have stronger states. And in particular, the leaders developed pretty large and intrusive plainclothes and police states to watch and regulate the economy. So even people who try and make a living in the informal sector are often harassed and shaken down by the police. And indeed, that's how all this started. It was a college graduate who couldn't find work, who was a fruit vendor in a rural town in Tunisia, who was stopped by police. He had his fruit cart confiscated. That was his only way of supporting his family. He was angry. He went to the district headquarters and said, I need my cart back. There's no reason for you to do this. I'll pay the fine, but all my life savings are invested in that cart and my stock. I need it back. And they just said, no, you have to go get in line for a license in 6 months. Maybe we'll give one to you. And he was so frustrated and humiliated, he set himself on fire, which would not necessarily have sparked a revolution, except that so many hundreds of thousands of young people throughout the region shared that anger at petty harassment, blocked opportunities, worthless education, while seeing corrupt cronies of the government pull in tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars from deals with foreign companies and government-guaranteed monopolies. So there was a lot of anger there. The crucial factor, however, that led these regimes to fall was that the military was no longer willing to support them. Now, the reason for that is this is something actually that is very common in these kind of sultanistic, personalized regime. If you have a government that is a military junta, the military is deeply involved in all aspects of the government. If you have a Communist Party. The party usually has cadres throughout the military keeping people involved. But if you have an individual who has been in power for 15, 20 years and is concentrating power in his own hands, he usually doesn't want the military to be strong because the last thing he wants is for the military to act against him. So the common pattern in these sultanistic regimes, which also was the case in Egypt and Tunisia, is that the political leader kept the army at arm's length, usually divided the military commands, kept the army and the air force and the secret police separate from each other, and didn't designate a successor, presented himself as indispensable. Well, that works for a while, but it also means that the army is kind of left on the outside looking at the leadership and saying, if there's a demonstration, if there's a mass protest, are we going to shoot people? It's not to defend the country. It's not to defend a regime whose ideology we believe in. There is no ideology. It's shooting people simply to keep a very corrupt leader and his family in power. And very commonly, when push comes to shove, the army is not willing to do that. And in particular in Egypt, the army, who had gone into business with a lot of local businessmen in Egypt, was furious at Gamal Mubarak, who had kind of taken charge of foreign investment and was steering foreign capital into buying up various assets in Egypt. So the army really did not like Gamal Mubarak and did not want him to succeed his father and had been worrying about how to do it. So when they saw public demonstrations, I think they thought, this is great. If we can get Mubarak out, we'll stop the succession to Gamal and we can step in there. So it's been fairly typical in a country, say, like the Philippines, where Ferdinand Marcos was our friend, but his regime fell apart when the army revolted in the face of protest. In Indonesia, Suharto tried to direct succession to his family, but when the Asian financial crisis came, the army deserted him as well. And so we have a situation in Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, even Libya, where very corrupt personal dictators have been in power a long time, high unemployment, high food prices spur popular protests, and the army simply says, we're not going to shoot people to save you. Now, in Libya, Gaddafi has mercenaries who have no place in society except to follow him, and he has some tribal loyalties that he can draw on, so he's holding on a bit longer. But I don't expect him to last because the morale of the opposition is very high, and the people fighting against them are just fighting for a paycheck or to protect themselves and their tribe. I expect them to start deserting soon as the weight of world opinion condemns Gaddafi and asks for him to go. So will this wave spread? Not widely. The regime in Iran is very different. There are many leaders of the government in Iran, Rafsanjani, Larijani, Ahmadinejad, Khamenei. You can't just lose one person and overthrow that regime. Similarly, there's still ideology supporting that. A large number of the people in Iran still see the government as embodying Shia and Persian nationalism against a hostile world. And in particular, the recruits to the militia and the Revolutionary Guard are ideologically committed to the government and deeply involved in it. Many ministers are Revolutionary Guard officers. So there's very little chance that the repressive forces will simply stand aside or peel away, which is why popular revolts, even though widespread, have not succeeded in Iran. Finally, what about Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Bahrain, Oman, Jordan? Well, you're going to see protests there because they have the same combination of high grain prices, large youth cohorts, high youth unemployment. But monarchies still have more traditional respect, and they have more options. The monarch can keep a fair bit of executive power, but give some power to a legislature and elected officials. In other words, they can retreat from absolute monarchy to constitutional monarchy and still keep things substantially intact. And that's what I think we're going to see a lot of. We've already seen the Jordanians and the Saudis change their cabinet. Saudis, in fact, just today announced a major change in the cabinet. I think we'll see some liberalizing reforms as a way to stave off greater change. Now, all of this doesn't mean things will be hunky-dory. because when sultanistic regimes fall, it takes years to sort out the problems they leave behind. I think we're very likely to see a lot of messy contestation, democracies that veer back toward authoritarianism or corruption. But I don't think we'll see, as some people fear, the rise of Islamic extremism. Every anti-sultanist revolution in the last 30 years, in Indonesia, in the Philippines, in Georgia, none of them led to extremist, ideologically driven regimes. It's quite a historical change because all of the dictators that were overthrown in the first half of the 20th century, in Cuba, in China, in Vietnam, were succeeded by ideologically extreme governments. Now, there's a reason for that. During the Cold War, intellectuals said, if you're going to overthrow a U.S. allied government, you want communist help and you want to take the communist model. But now that model's not attractive anymore. No intellectuals see communism or even Iran-style Islam as a model for democracy and economic prosperity. So I think we can look forward to messy democracy, but democracy nonetheless. I think this really does herald a decline in dictatorships throughout the Middle East, and I think it's historically long overdue and a good thing to welcome.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Before I start, I just want to thank a couple people, Claire Morgan and Erica Christensen at Mercatus, and also the leaders of our economics club, Leah, Carly, Meg, and Maria. These undergraduates are amazing. They're some of the most passionate, entrepreneurial, and hardworking undergraduates I've ever had the opportunity to work with. So I appreciate you organizing all this. Full disclosure, I'm the advisor to the economics club. That means I know how hard you work. I'm going to be both an optimist and a pessimist. I'm going to be an optimist about the possibility of social change in other societies, but what I want to be a pessimist about is U.S. foreign policy. And I want to highlight two points that we can discuss further during the Q&A, but I want to highlight them. They're major points, and I think what's going on in the Middle East right now brings these issues to the forefront. The first is that what's going on in the Middle East is really, in my view, an indictment of U.S. nation building, and more specifically, the idea that social change toward freedom must be initiated by outside forces. Think about this. The U.S. has been in Afghanistan now for about a decade, and we have been unsuccessful in winning the hearts and minds of Afghan citizens. It took a matter of weeks, basically a month, for the initial uprising in Egypt to the resignation by Mubarak. And basically what this shows is the flaws in the widespread mentality that underpins most, if not all, U.S. foreign interventions. And there's basically two aspects to this mentality. The first is that certain societies are unable to move towards freedom without some exogenous shock, mainly from the U.S., either through aid or through direct or indirect military intervention. The second is that the complex array of institutions that underpin a society are the result of some grand plan of experts. Now, of course, as Jack pointed out, there's no way to know whether the uprisings in the Middle East will ultimately result in increased freedom. But what we can conclude at this point, at least, is that we can be confident that there is a possibility for indigenous liberation, in other words, for indigenous social change that doesn't need some kind of exogenous shock. At a minimum, I want to suggest that the events in the Middle East should be cause for increased humility, both in the current U.S. interventions in Afghanistan and Iraq, but also in other potential future interventions. We should recognize that the U.S. is just not very good at either predicting or facilitating social change abroad. In addition to the ongoing issues in Iraq and Afghanistan, consider that U.S. intelligence agencies, which are probably the best in the world, really had no idea. They were unable to predict that these revolutions were going to happen. As Jack pointed out, we, as social scientists, we have some idea of the conditions that are associated with revolutions, broadly speaking. But as the important work of Timur Kuran has illustrated, it's very hard to predict when revolutions are going to happen. Because, of course, if we could predict it, at least with some degree of uncertainty, they oftentimes wouldn't happen because they would be squelched. Now, I'm skeptical that U.S. policymakers will recognize these lessons, at least in the short run, the importance of spontaneous indigenous revolutions. This is obvious just from the comments of the Obama administration. Of course, after supporting the Mubarak regime for decades, and then once this started, they initially supported them. Of course, they want to be on the right side of history. So when it became evident that he wasn't going to be remain in power, they started calling for an orderly transition to democracy. Of course, the notion of an orderly transition somehow suggests that the transition between different institutional regimes is somehow a neat or linear process that can be understood or planned or ordered according to some plan. Now, the second point I'd like to make is that we need to seriously reconsider the foreign aid that the United States gives to the worst governments in the world. And I think what's happening in the Middle East calls this this issue into light. Consider that Egypt has received over $25 billion of U.S. development assistance and $40 billion in U.S. military assistance. Now, I think that's the range you gave for Mubarak's personal wealth. I'm not saying all that went to him, but it's about basically what we've given him in foreign aid is his wealth. So there's some irony there. And that, of course, he assumed power in 1981. In President Obama's fiscal year 2011 budget, there was a $1.5 billion in aid requested for Egypt. $1.3 billion of that was supposed to be allocated to the military, what we call peace and security. Moving beyond Egypt, a fascinating article which recently appeared in Fortune magazine noted that between 2007 and 2010, the U.S. Defense Department requested that Congress approve arms packages to the Middle East, which totaled over $180 billion. Now, $100 billion of that came under the Obama administration. So we should be very honest about this, and we should also have a critical discussion we should have a critical discussion regarding the tension that this causes. And the tension's as follows. The U.S. is a supposed champion of peace and freedom, but at the same time, we're the world's lord of war. In other words, we're one of the, if not the world's largest arms dealer, while supposedly promoting freedom and peace. Now, these are not the only cases of the U.S. providing aid to the world's worst governments. Every year, Parade magazine ranks the 10 worst dictators in the world. And if you just look at this list, the United States has given some form of aid to each of these regimes at some point in time, both development aid and military aid. Now, I want you to keep in mind that the leaders in these countries are the worst of the worst. We worry here when, you know, Charlie Rangel uses stationery for fundraising, or when he lies on his tax return. These are the least of the worries in these countries. These people are willing to maim, rape, murder both innocent adults and children in order to remain their to maintain their hold on power. Now, there are some justifications for giving aid to these dictators that we should at least consider. One justification for giving aid is that it allows the U.S. to achieve broader strategic goals that are in our interest. In other words, we can basically have client states, buy friends, if you will, in order to pursue broader goals. Now, if this is true, we should just admit it. We should drop all the rhetoric about democracy, self-determination, and human rights. And instead, in the name of transparency, which is a hallmark of liberal democracy, and which our representatives in the U.S. government claim that the U.S. upholds, we should just be honest. We should admit that we're paying off the most repugnant leaders in the world in order to further our national interests, despite the significant cost that this imposes on ordinary citizens who must live under these governments. As economists, we recognize that life's all about trade-offs, so we might as well be honest about them and stop pretending that we can have our freedom-promoting cake and eat it too. A second common justification for the provision of aid is that it's necessary to reform the governments in these countries. In theory, effective government reforms which are supported by aid can generate significant benefits, as our first speaker discussed, in terms of development and other benefits which will accrue to citizens. At first blush, this seems to be an appropriate justification. However, this suffers from several major problems. The way the aid community works is that it doesn't come in and dispose of the leader. It works through these governments in order to achieve reforms. This means that the very source of the problem, the predatory state, is tasked with playing a central and crucial role in solving the problem of which its existence is the very cause. The result is the well-known pitfalls of aid, such as increased corruption and aid effectiveness. The bigger question we need to consider and ask ourselves is why we would ever expect the most brutal dictators in the world to suddenly act in the public interest by adopting reforms that will reduce their power. Now, the international aid community is well aware of these issues. I'm not saying anything new. Of course, for the last couple decades, they've been focusing on this notion of good governance, the idea being that if we can reform government and put constraints on them, we can get the reforms that are necessary to generate development. The issue, of course, is this gap between the know what and the know how. We know what good governance looks like. In other words, we can write down a list of characteristics that a constrained and effective government have. What we're lacking is the know-how of how to go about implementing these reforms to get good governance where they don't already exist. But one thing we can be very sure about is that absent effective constraints on the grabbing hand of the state, funneling millions, if not billions, of dollars of aid into these countries will not only fail to increase freedom, but will cause significant harms to innocent people in the process. Thank you very much.
Good evening, and thank you for the opportunity. My fellow panelists haven't left anything for me to talk about, so might as well talk about sports. I guess one of the key changes in the events of the beginning of the towards the end of last year and the beginning of this year is the what we are now know as the Facebook revolution. And contrary to all the other political theories that have known revolutions and the organization of revolution or change, this one has started from virtual reality and translated, luckily, to reality itself. Now, why started from Egypt and Tunisia? It's simply because they're one of the most educated and well-connected countries in the Arab world. Why did this play a role in turning this virtual revolution into a real revolution is the fact that this is not a new phenomenon. It has been boiling in Egypt specifically for the past 5 years, started with the April movement and the events of 2007, all related to the internet, to blogging. Lots of bloggers have gone behind bars for years. As a matter of fact, one of our colleagues was just released from a four-year sentence because he defamed the president and religion. For 4 years, he was behind bars. Karim is his name. The reason is Egyptian society, the Egyptian society in particular, and the Arab world in general, they have the youth that my colleagues have discussed, who have college education, who are out of a job, but nonetheless different than any other generations before them, have this virtue of being connected to the world. And what does that mean? As I grew up in Iraq through the Iran-Iraq war and the first Gulf War and then the toppling of Saddam, one thing that was lacking was connectivity to the world. We had no way until the mid-90s to know what was going on in the world. Our world was the world of our city or the only TV channel that we had that was government-run and the only two newspapers that were government-run. In such an environment, your perception of the world, of how it functions, is very, very limited. Now, what changed with the age of the internet, and specifically Facebook and YouTube, is the fact that savvy Egyptians and Tunisian youth have been connected with each other and with the outside world, both for networking and for realizing what is happening in the rest of the world that brings the question to the minds of these young, energetic, educated people. Why are we living like this? Why are we being beaten by the police with no accountability? Why one of our colleagues have been beaten to death because he just went to an internet cafe last year, who's become one of the symbols of the revolution? And what triggered these movements? When all these young people have had nothing else to fear to lose and have nothing else in front of them to look for except for organizing and doing this. Now, I have spoken to some of the Egyptians who have been organizing or actively involved, and you might have seen some of them on television. They probably did not expect this outcome, but nonetheless, they took it on themselves, and it succeeded. Why is Egypt important of all the other countries? As some historical factors, and I would like to talk about the place of Egypt in the Islamic world, and what does that have to do with the Arab identity and then the Islamic identity, and I'll briefly shed some light on the history of the Muslim Brotherhood and their significance in this movement and the worries that we have. Egypt, for the past century, in the 20th century, was one of the most active countries, both politically and intellectually, among the Arab countries. It has a significant amount of art production, of filmmaking, of music, and of intellectual products, good universities, religious and non-religious. What these countries have suffered from after colonialism was a search for an identity which was in the beginning or during the fight against colonialism was a united national identity, which was the Arab identity. And with their fight and with their success for removing colonialism and having to suffer under the puppet regimes that the colonialists have left behind, significantly in Egypt, in Iraq, those governments nonetheless have continued that were nationalist government, I mean Egyptian government, non-colonialist, but still satellites to the colonial powers, mainly the Brits. And with the revolutions in the mid-50s of the last century of nationalization, of change from monarchy to republic, has given a burst, a good boost to the Arab morale of revival, of regaining the lost identity, the lost dignity. With that came the emergence of Islamic identity, which side by side with the Arab nationalist identity has been on the rise to heal that wound and to regain that lost hope and lost empire, which, by the way, 87 years ago today was the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire, which was the last Islamic empire after the First World War, 1924 today. The nationalist, alongside with the socialists, due to the socialist bloc, the Soviet bloc, they were the two main powers that played the politics in the Arab world in general, from the east to the west. And they both have failed significantly, because the main discourse of the nationalists was anti-Israel rhetoric and anti-Western rhetoric, which has been which went away with the Camp David agreement between Israel and Egypt, and then the socialists have always followed the communist parties of the Arab world, allied to the international communist parties and the Soviet Union, have all followed they always made the wrong decisions no matter what, and they lost their popularity, and in the midst of that, the Islamic movements have gained momentum, because they were both reviving their religious and the national, the Arabic identity. And let's not forget that Arabs still take pride that Islam is their religion, because the Quran was sent in their language for them, which was true all the way through revelation of the Quran. Now, why did these Islamic movements become stronger and stronger in the face of the dictatorships that ruled the Arab world, and why did they become the the main fear that led the U.S. and the Western world to support dictatorships in order to keep them at bay, keep those Islamic movements at bay. And these theories that they, if Mubarak would go down, as we all saw, even during his second speech, that if he were to step down, chaos will eat the country and the region, which we found out very soon that it wasn't true, and it's not going to be true. And in reference to Christopher's point of the intelligence, the U.S. intelligence, and how they failed to see those things, where people have an interest to revive that myth that the Islamic movements were of the mega power that could reunite the Arab world, start an Islamic empire, and then destroy the entire world, which is too far from reality. And all the evidence that comes out now about the Muslim Brotherhood, as it was until recently, one of the fears that of the toppling of the Mubarak regime, was that their popularity is not that gigantic to worry that in the first democratic election they will take over and they start an Islamic state in Egypt, which will be implementing Sharia law. As a matter of fact, only yesterday, one of their leaders came out and announced that they're going to change from a group into a political party, which is a very promising move, and they're going to accept Christian Egyptians as members of that political party, and their mandate is going to be a civil government in Egypt. Islam will be the foundation of the legislation, a source of the legislation, and it will be based on citizenship. Now, this is a change that we haven't seen, we didn't expect. The reason is we didn't look carefully enough, we didn't read the signals very well. On the other side, the Islamic movement embodied in the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the umbrella or the foundation of the ideological discourse for other Islamic movements in the Arab world, has realized that Sharia law cannot rule a world that is interconnected, that the jihadist philosophy that they advocated for from the beginning, or at least in the 50s all the way to the 80s, to turn all these those dictators and establish the Islamic ruling, has changed dramatically, which is a very promising point in the direction that that fear is not real, and that the change that what we call now political change, which is just a scratch on the surface of the Egyptian regime, if we talk about Egypt, only today they fired the prime minister, who was appointed by Mubarak in his first move after the demonstration started. And the regime is still in place. And one of the interesting factors about the Egyptian military, as it was mentioned, and its role in keeping the calmness of the country, was not only from the good heart of the generals of the Egyptian army, but because of an economic fact that they are a big stakeholder in the Egyptian economy, and they own some of the major industries in Egypt, and their interests as an institution is connected with the stability of Egypt and the keeping of the system as intact as possibly they could do. I would like to just shed some light on the experience of Iraq and the war. I was one of the supporters of the war because. To me, that was the only way Saddam's regime could be toppled. And in one of the discussions with my father, who has been a revolutionary forever since I know him, against the regime, and we've been suffering under Saddam. He told me that why do we need the American intervention to end Saddam? I said, and my answer was very simple. I said, well, you've been fighting for 35 years and you couldn't do anything. Now we might change some course. The reason why I'm mentioning this is I have a feeling of revisiting my opinion of that time of whether if I, with the knowledge that I have now, would say the same thing had this time been 2003. And the answer would be no, because one of the interesting factors that is now changing and brought to Egypt and Tunisia and now in Libya and most of the other Arab countries is that the citizens, the people who live in that country, have realized, have gained back the consciousness that they matter, they are important as individuals. What these regimes did throughout the Arab country was to reduce the individual, the person of any of those countries, into a number in a statistic that they withhold. And by reducing a human being to just a machine, by stripping them of their political beliefs, by stripping them of their value as a human being, as an agent that could bring about a change, that could do something, they have managed to control these people for decades. Now, this has changed, and that's why the fire is spreading like fire spreads in what is the expression, in grass, in dry grass. It's because people have realized finally that they can do something. They their existence, their voice, their movement has some meaning, and that's why in places like Saudi Arabia, now there are movements that are about to be organized. There are demands that are being written. As a matter of fact, one of the rare events, rare occurrences, was that 2,000 people have signed a petition with their names on it for change. This is an unheard of incident that people did not expect that will happen in Saudi Arabia. And of course the other countries are following. There were calls for demonstrations in Iraq on the 25th of this month. It took place, but it wasn't on a large scale. But things have started, and they're not going to stop. My last comment will be on whether these changes will bring about prosperity for those countries. That remains to be seen on an economical level. What is important, what I am optimistic about personally, is that people have rose up and trying to take matters back into their hands. Now, with good guidance, and I'm not saying aid or intervention, but with good guidance, which I and my colleagues at Atlas are doing, trying to provide the literature that would show the Egyptians in particular that there is a way to prosperity by limiting your government, by establishing the rule of law, the institution that civil institution that would organize the country, and lifting all those government restrictions on business and on trade, and these are fast changing times, and people are grappling with these ideas newly, and there is a fear that the socialist system that has been ruling these countries since the republics in Egypt, in Iraq, and so on, are still in place, and people are looking up to the state as the sole caretaker and food provider. And if this mentality changes, things might change to a direction of more progress and prosperity for those countries. Thank you.
We have a little bit of time for Q&A.
You touched briefly on the role that the military has in the economy of Egypt. I've been very interested in reading about this recently and hearing about this recently. I keep getting this impression that the military generals out there are a little bit more like mafia dons or something. I mean, they're running hotels and other clearly non-military businesses. But I don't have a good sense of the scale. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how big the military's role in the overall economy is. Also, if you could mention some of the statistics that you had up earlier about the percentage of people working for the government. If you work in the military, are you counted as working in the government? Is that considered a public sector job? And then lastly, how much independence do the heads of the military have? Do they have their own little, like, charismatic cults, as a sense? Are they kind of rotated? And to what degree has the Egyptian government been able to divide and conquer the military, like, as a mass, as you had mentioned they tried to do in other places? Thank you.
I wish I could answer that. I'm not a military expert. I just look around a bit in the economic part. But in truth, I don't think anybody really knows, except perhaps the CIA. The military expenditures are not included in the civilian budget that are being sent to Parliament. It is not an issue that anybody can ever ask. So now the allegation that the military owns a lot of industries and so on is you have to sort of look at it carefully, understand the background to that. If you have the largest structure, organized structure that is well run, and it is the military, then you will have former generals who've retired who run other industries. Okay? So you do have many other industries that are run by ex-military people. Now, do they own it? Is that part of the military? I don't know, honestly. But it's easy to come away with that impression. I mean, if one looks at the staffing in Lockheed Marietta or Boeing or Grumman, you will find a lot of ex-military people there too. So, you know, the scale may be different, but that may be the thing. But honestly, the answer is I don't know.
One point is that there is something in Egypt, as it used to be in Iraq, called military industry, which is a huge establishment of industries, heavy industries. In Iraq, went all the way to producing weapons, sophisticated weapons, that were all run by the military apparatus, and it was part of the state. Now, we have clearly a very good distinction in the case of Egypt between the civilian government, what we call the government, and then the interests of the state. And the way the military was insulated from all the other connections to the public life was by keeping it this sacred institution, as it is still viewed as a sacred institution, which is very surprising to anyone, and especially to the revolution in Egypt, to call on the military to save the revolution, while it was the contrary in all the previous, conventional knowledge that we have. Now, they do have that, and yes, they have a stake in those things. And I think in one of the WikiLeaks reports, there was a cable that talks about Tantawi in person, who's now in charge of the Supreme Military Council, who wants to keep the status quo. And that's why the animosity between the military leaders and Jamal Mubarak was so clear, because Jamal was trying to veer the country to more business-oriented, and that's why he brought his friend businessmen, and they accumulated a lot of wealth in the meanwhile, and that has created a challenge.
Unfortunately, we don't have any more time for questions, but if you'd like to continue the discussion, you can stay after the event. If you're here for Nick Snow's 385 class, we have sign-up sheets over on the table, And thank you guys for coming out tonight, and let's thank our panelists.